Hey everyone, welcome to Film Class Zeros. We watch old flicks and we talk about them as film nerds do. I'm Alex, and with me is the OG Thief of Hearts, Rich. What's up, dude?
What's up, man? I appreciate that intro. I do steal a lot of hearts.
Stole mine a long time ago.
Aww.
Yes, sir. Today we are talking about Robin Hood, Men in Tights, the Mel Brooks classic. I call it a classic. And we're going to dive into it. We have a lot to talk about because this movie leans so heavily on the Kevin Costner Robin Hood Prince of Thieves movie, as well as the overall Robin Hood tale. So we did a lot of homework for this one.
A lot went into this, and I think both movies are fascinating. I love Men in Tights. I remember getting it on, renting it on VHS. And I also remember really loving Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And I went to see that when it came out in 1991 with my mom. And immediately afterwards, she bought me two figures. She got me the Robin Hood action figure, which was actually a repainted Green Lantern or Green Arrow superpowers figure that they repackaged, and the Sheriff of Nottingham. Now, that being said, we both kind of had the same idea. Let's watch Prince of Thieves, and then let's watch the parody, Men in Tights, which we're going to talk about. But Prince of Thieves, man, listen, I don't know if you feel the same way. A lot of that movie does not hold up.
Okay, interesting. I liked it a lot more during the rewatch. And I remember liking it, but I haven't seen either movie in a very long time. And Prince of Thieves was just super accessible. It was on Netflix. And I said, you know what? I should watch this because I want to find out a couple things. I want to go in asking, do you need to watch Prince of Thieves to get or enjoy Men in Tights? Because it's such a direct parody. And I wanted to see if either movie, you know, if both movies hold up. So when I watched it, I did like it. I can't wait to talk about what you think doesn't work anymore. I have some notes too, but this is going to be a very interesting discussion. So before we kick off, I just want to say, why did we pick this Mel Brooks movie? If we want to talk about Mel Brooks, it's not one of his, you know, magnum opus films. Personally, I picked it because it was always on when we were younger, and it was likely my intro to Mel Brooks. I don't know if it was the same thing to you. So I felt like if we're going to talk about Mel Brooks, this is a good place to start. It's a convenient entry point to Mel Brooks' style, humor, and his body of work. There are lots of references to this. And like we said, you know, we watched this movie, we watched Prince of Thieves. I watched the behind the scenes video of the making of Men in Tights, which, you know, that's a thing. So, lots to talk about.
Yeah. This was not particularly my intro to Mel Brooks, even though it was 1993. I was like 12, 13 around the time. I have an older brother. My brother's 12 years my senior. So when I was growing up, Mel Brooks movies were on the TV a lot, you know, and I vividly remember seeing Spaceballs for the first time when we helped him move from dorm to dorm. And it was just on the TV and I was hooked. I was useless and hooked. I may have been like 8 or 9 years old at the time. And I remember being like a dope, kind of pointing at the TV and being like, it's like Star Wars, but it's not Star Wars, you know? And I think this is a great, like you said, I think it's a great Mel Brooks movie to start with because it's produced extremely well. We could have done Young Frankenstein. We could have done Blazing Saddles, which we will get to eventually on this show. And we both love those movies. You know, Silent Movie, The Producers, Life Stinks, you
History
know,
of
like,
the World.
History of the World, of course. Like, there's so many Mel Brooks movies to talk about, and we will get to all of them. Even Dracula Dead and Loving It, at some point, we're going to do that. but this movie is such a perfect... It's a perfect movie that exemplifies the oddball early 90s because of all the references in it.
Oof.
But that being said, it starts out with this kind of it's a parody of Prince of Thieves, right? But also a parody of the genre, and also a parody of the Robin Hood story. So it's a lot of things in one movie. Did you get the sense of that as well?
Yeah. So I think that going into it, I think it was very clear on its face that it's a parody of the Prince of Thieves movie, which came out a couple years before this one. So like Mel Brooks saw this movie and then immediately turned around and said like, hey, we got to parody this. I mean, that's probably not how it happened, but it must have taken place immediately after Prince of Thieves, which was huge at the time. So that movie was everywhere, and I can see how, you know, Mel Brooks and his writing team suddenly were like inspired because it was everywhere. It's a genre that they wanted to send up, and they got to work. And like classically with Mel Brooks, he's always referencing and playing with the idea of show business. So it's like show business and movie making and all the parts to it, because that's the world that he lives in. So a lot of the things that he does and the environment that he exists in, he uses in all his films. So this movie is, you know, it parodies and sends up the classic Errol Flynn Robin Hood, which, you know, has such the through lines from that movie to all the Robin Hoods ever made are very prominent. And also that classic old Hollywood stuff that he grew up watching and participated in later, and puts it in this movie. So we see a lot of Prince of Thieves. We see a lot of Errol Flynn. We see a lot of classic Hollywood tropes and jokes and references. And it's this big mix of references and humor that covers a very wide field of humor. You know, it's references for older people, it's references for younger people at the time, and it's super, super interesting to watch it now, several decades after the fact.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff in this, it's very meaty in terms of references. You know, like I immediately equate his old-timey Hollywood references to kind of watching like a Tarantino flick, except, you know, obviously Mel Brooks is a comedian and a humorist, and these are comedy movies. But in the same regard, it's like, you know, you get these nods to like really oddball things, you know, like, for example, the hangman in this movie is the hangman from Blazing Saddles.
Right.
And he's called Boris the Hangman. And if you notice, he kind of talks like this, right? He's got that kind of voice to him, you know, no news is good news, right? So in my head, I'm like, I wonder why he gave that guy that voice. Oh, his name is Boris the Hangman. Oh, like Boris Pickett, the guy who sang Monster Mash, because that's the affectation that guy uses on that song, you know? Wow. So that's kind of like a weird like trajectory. And there's so many different references like that are just there, you know? And he's done that in all his, like Mel Brooks has done that in like all his flicks, you know? And I was doing like a lot of backwards research into just like the production of this and like who was in it. And it's like so many old timey, like TV stars, you know? Sure. And it's mind boggling. And it's a really cool thing that Mel Brooks has always done, where like he puts all these people in his movies. Now, that being said, Cary Elwes, before we get into the meat of the movie, I want to talk about how my entire life I've always wanted Cary Elwes to play a serious Robin Hood, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he looks just like Errol Flynn.
Yeah.
But I think that's impossible. After rewatching this movie, his comedic timing and presence and goofiness are so in your face that it changed my mind. I was like, you know what? This is his perfect Robin Hood.
It's interesting that you say that, because I feel like the portrayal that you want to see, the closest, you know, he's obviously much older now, the closest we'll ever get to that, or that he would ever do, is he had already done with Princess Bride, because it was the same sort of earnest classic hero. You know, he was a swashbuckler and all this other stuff, and here he's playing it for laughs. He's playing it for laughs, but playing it like super sincerely. But in the other movie, he's playing, you know, it's very straight, you know, it's not trying to be funny. And I think Cary Elwes doing what you are asking for, that's you mean that's basically it. He'd basically be doing the Princess Bride role.
So like you're saying, Cary Elwes as the Dread Pirate Roberts is as serious as we would get him.
Exactly.
In this time frame. So that's interesting. So let me ask you a question. Princess Bride came out in 1987. This movie came out in 1993. It's a 6-year difference, right? When you were a kid or even as an adult, did you not think that Princess Bride came out in the early 80s?
Yeah, I feel like it did. And I feel like the way I remember The Princess Bride is that when the grandfather's reading the story to the kid, I'm thinking that I thought it was a real book. I thought this was something that I should have known. Like, it's a classic story and all this other stuff. I was really, obviously we didn't have expanded universes and lore and all this other stuff, but we had adaptations and, whatever we watched, for the most part, we could find out if there was like a book or something related to it. And I was watching that thinking that this was like an existing story or existing property. And I believed that for a very, very long time until I realized that it was all just, made for the movie.
Well, that's a testament to movie magic in and of itself.
Oh, 100%. That spoke to us because I feel like we were very much that child's age at the time. So, we could have, it was very easy to place ourselves in that, that position.
We were all baby Fred Savages.
Exactly. I'm forgetting everyone's name today.
It's okay, man. So,
that's right. So I was like the grandfather and the child who read the book.
I know you mean Peter Falk and Fred Savage.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, Columbo read a story to a dude.
I know what you're saying. And I think if anybody's listening to this, they know exactly what you're saying. So you're endearing yourself. You're endearing yourself into the public heart and mind right now, collectively.
Thank you. I that's very kind of you to say. Very generous. The names that I do know are the ones written in front of me for our notes. So it's Cary Elwes, Amy Esbeck as Maid Marian, Roger Rees, who is the Sheriff of Rottingham. And I had to put that there because I was going to get that wrong. Dave Chappelle makes his film debut, and Richard Lewis as Prince John. Amazing cast for this movie. And we should start talking about the differences, I think, between this one and the Kevin Costner movie.
Dude, so both flicks start in Jerusalem, where in Prince of Thieves, they mention that he's in Jerusalem because he got captured. He's helping out with the Crusades, or he's actually trying to be more of a defender of the people, like kind of a mediator in Prince of Thieves. Mm-hmm. And in Men in Tights, he just gets thrown in jail, for like a dopey crime. And he meets a Sneeze, played by Isaac Hayes. In the parallel in Prince of Thieves is Aziz, played by Morgan Freeman. Fantastic in that role, by the way.
Absolutely.
So they escape. They start both movies are started very similarly, except I kind of want to point out the opening credits to Men in Tights is very old Hollywood, like a Western, pretty fantastic. The archers are firing arrows at the screen and they kind of burn away into credits, it reminded me of like a 50s Western. So a Sneeze tells Robin, hey, go meet Achu, my son, who's played by Dave Chappelle. There's certain things in this movie that I will always giggle about. One is that Dave Chappelle's character is named Achu.
Right.
And there's a couple of other things later on that, when we get to it, I will have another laugh on the show. So he plays Robin Aloxi. He finds that his home was taken by Prince John because King Richard is still in the Crusades. And it's pretty similar to Prince of Thieves, like the groundwork for Men in Tights, I think, definitely uses Prince of Thieves as like a storyboard. So that probably cut off a lot of writing time, as with, let's say, Young Frankenstein, right?
Yeah, I think the very interesting thing about Prince of Thieves is that it was such a big part of the legend that it grew on it, even though it was just a film adaptation, mm-hmm. But from that movie onward, all these things were added to the legend and made sort of as official as it gets. You know, the original stories didn't have the Crusades. This is the writers of that movie doing the homework and putting it into context where it's like, well, King Richard isn't there. You know, Robin isn't Robin Hood the outlaw. He's Robin of Locksley. He is, you know, a son of a nobleman, and he is, you know, a young, headstrong guy who fights with his dad and goes off to war, you know, against his wishes, to go and just be, you know, like a cocky little jerk, like we all were at that age, and you know, being rebellious. And he goes to fight the, you know, a religious crusade, and then realize, oh my God, this is horrible. You know, learns all like these really rough life lessons while fighting to survive and being like basically an invader. And then he comes back, and these things now are parodied in this movie, and they have become part of it because there was no Azim and, you know, like a Saracen or Moor, but this has been sort of made into the legend from here on out, because we just say, well, if it's so perfectly that just that ball kept rolling, and this movie goes with that. So the beginning starts very, like you said, like it's a very good parallel. And I talking about giggling and tittering at all like these little things, we will be doing that a lot because there are so many small things that are so endearing to this movie. My first, one of my favorites, and the first one is this whole jail scene when Robin is led in Prince of Thieves, and it's treated like there's like a maitre d', and he's given a house beard because he has to match the dress code, and just all like these little things that are thrown into this scene alone, and it's a perfect setup to the movie.
It really is, and it's also right off the bat, you know, you also get a scene of men rapping the story at you. Right. Which is very contemporary for the time, 1993, you know, like you were still transitioning from late 80s kind of hip hop into what the early 90s were before you got to like the whole gangster rap thing of the mid 90s. So it was a very like old school kind of rap number that happens. And a very interesting thing about this movie is like you have jokes like the maitre d' or the concierge at the prison, which I feel like those jokes are evergreen. That is a timeless joke. You could put that joke in any comedy and it'll work. The thing that this movie does, which, you know, watching it now 30 years later, which is I find fascinating, is that it's a 50-50 split between your contemporary, your evergreen jokes and the jokes that are only really relevant for that early 90s time frame.
I think that's a generous split, to be honest with you. I feel like there's a lot of 90s stuff in here. In fact, the notes that I started taking for this, I just started writing like 90s stuff and just making like a checklist, because that's the only context that this the joke exists in.
It's really bizarre in a weird way, and I feel like if somebody watched this movie now, they wouldn't get a lot of the references. Like, for example, the introduction to a chew is Dave Chappelle's character is getting beat up by a bunch of like henchmen. Right.
Right.
And at one point he goes, I wish somebody had a video camera, which is in reference to the Rodney King beating.
Right.
And if you watch that now, 30 years later, it would make sense in the world of TikTok and Instagram. But you wouldn't get the heart of the reference. You know, there's a lot of that stuff that happens in this movie, and we'll kind of point that out as we go along. But then, you know, you'll have a joke that will always work, like the concierge or all this stuff, like the beard joke, you know, like you need to look the part. So they give him like a house beard.
Well, that's interesting too, because I mean, like, I feel like this is a reference to something that has also gone out of fashion even before the 90s, but as we were growing up, this is something that sort of faded away. And that's the idea of men requiring a jacket to go to certain restaurants. And that sounds really funny now, because, you know, the concept of there's certain things that have changed. Like, there is a a dress code. And yeah. if you fail the dress code, you are not admitted to dine. But restaurants had house clothing or jackets just to, you know, keep up the level of elegance that they are aspiring for. And, you know, it's even like having like smoking and no smoking sections is such a foreign thing now because they are mm-hmm. so thing. So, you know, now in our adulthood, thinking about references or places where a restaurant, not that they don't have dress codes, but going to a restaurant where there is like a specific jacket dress code requirement and that they would have a house jacket, I think is such a rare thing. I get that, like, even that I think is a bit of a dated joke, but it's not as specific. It's not a super 90s thing. It's just like a culture, like right at the cultural shift.
Yeah. I think people having to dress up for certain things has not really faded. I think it's almost there for sure. Like, you know, like your Friars Club type situation, you yeah. know, or, you know, like any kind of like really high end place like that. I wasn't let into the Nomad Hotel once to have a drink because I was wearing a Motorhead t-shirt. And
they just don't like the band.
I you know, it's kind of funny. I'm going to tell this quick story because it's a good story. So I went to the Nomad Hotel, great bar. I've been there plenty of times. And one day I walked in with my wife and I was wearing a Motorhead shirt. She was dressed nice. She was dressed like business casual. I was wearing a Motorhead shirt and the guy at the door was like, "Hey, you can't come in here with that." I was like, "Why not?" I was like, "Well, you're wearing a t-shirt. We don't let people wearing t-shirts at the bar." And then I was like, "Well, that guy's wearing like a Tommy Bahama shirt and shorts." And he was like, "Well, he's staying here." And I was like, "Oh, that's kind of weird, right?" And I was like, "So I can't get a cocktail?" "No, sorry." And we left, right?
That guy was Lemmy though.
Now, that was years ago, right? This year, we went to Chicago and we went to this very high-end steakhouse. And the name escapes me right now, but okay. It's one of the higher-end steakhouses in Chicago, right?
Yeah.
I was wearing a Motorhead. It wasn't the same Motorhead shirt. I update my Motorhead shirts. It was a different Motorhead shirt. We unpack. I'm like, "Yeah, I want to get a steak." This steakhouse happened to be like a couple blocks from where we were staying. I was like, "Let's give it a shot." I'm wearing a Motorhead shirt. I'm wearing shorts. My wife dresses very well, so she's dressed to go out to dinner, right? Mm-hmm. Get to the restaurant. It's packed. Outside is packed, inside. Go to the counter. I go, "Hey, two for dinner." The guy looks at me and he goes, "We're pretty packed right now, but I'm going to let you in because of your shirt."
Awesome. That's awesome.
Right.
That's a great story. Yeah.
So got in because of the Motorhead t-shirt. Now, if the Nomad Hotel closes down, I will experience some kind of schadenfreude because of that. I will get joy out of that. I don't want to see people out of work, but I will get joy of the place that wouldn't allow me in for my Motorhead t-shirt to get shut down.
We got to take this recording goes live, you have to go there and do like the Pretty Woman thing. You'd be like, "Big mistake, huge. They let me in this other place."
I've never seen Pretty Woman. Feel,
oh, okay. Well, it's a reference for the people who have seen this movie.
Are we going to do Pretty Woman on this?
Might as well. I mean, there's no limit to the movies that we're going to watch.
I think we should do a watch along for Pretty Woman if we watch it, because I've never seen it. So it'll be kind of like one of those reverse Star Wars watchers for the first time. You've seen those videos? Like, yeah. Like we can watch movies that we've never had any interest in, like The Notebook or Pretty Woman.
Yeah, right. Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants or something.
So to continue, back to the movie at hand. Thank you guys for your patience. And listen, I'm going to take this time out to say, if you are listening to this, please follow us on Twitter at Film Zeros. We post every so often, and we're going to have a lot more stuff for you guys.
Sure. We try to give you a heads up of what movie we are watching so that you can rewatch it and be caught up in time for this conversation.
So do you want to take it from there escaping from prison, or do you want to move on? Because this is, we're not even done with the first scene of the movie.
No, I know. It's such a meaty discussion that we have here. The last thing I want to say is, like, I'm talking about jokes that land every time, no matter what, is when they trick the guard to go and get his superior so they have a chance to escape. They basically just got rid of him. They're like, this guy's going to confess. Go get your superiors. And he's like, oh, great. I'm going to get promoted. And good news is rewarded. Bad news is punished. And he leaves. And in that time, Robin and a sneeze have freed everyone and they leave. And he comes back to the empty jail cell. And he's like, guys, I just got back. And I'm in deep shit. And his line delivery lands every time. I cannot help but laugh at that. It's one of my favorite jokes.
Oh, it's such a good joke. It's such a good joke. I think, you know, like, again, that's an evergreen bit.
100%. So, but right after that is, you know, he goes to England. He swims because that's funny. And I never understood why James Chappelle wasn't just from the beginning. I don't understand. If it was just an excuse to have Isaac Hayes there, that's fine. But, you know, Isaac Hayes just kind of relinquishes his role as the Azeem parallel, and he goes, well, just go to England, my son is there, you know, a Chew, and he'll take over from here, keep an eye on him. And you know, Robin Hood immediately finds him, he's fighting the guards, and then, like, now the 90s stuff really kicks in, because he takes a time out in the beating of the fight and he goes, hold up guys, gotta pump up, and he has to pump up his Reebok shoes, which was a thing at the time for some reason. Again, it's one of the first, go ahead.
I think those are LA Gears, actually. I don't think they got the actual Reebok pumps. I think those are LA Gear pumps, and I'll tell you why, because I had a pair.
Everyone was doing it. It was the pumps. It was the having, like, that visible gap of air in the shoes. There were all the knockoffs. You know what would have been funny for this movie? If they were British Knights.
That would have been good.
Because it was England.
That would have been fantastic. Let me tell you, man, I had a pair of those LA Gear knockoff pumps, and I slam dunked once.
I jumped 10 feet in the air.
Yeah, so the movie is laden with 90s references, but also every second joke is a timeless joke.
For sure. Yeah, it's a one-on-one thing. So right after that, there's a Home Alone joke, which is, again, like, super zeitgeisty. And Robin now is home, and he's the movie starts to, again, parallel the Prince of Thieves, where he goes to his home and his family is dead and his land and title, they're all gone.
Yeah, so it kind of definitely follows Prince of Thieves in that regard, except I know you wrote that you wish Brian Blessed was in this movie as Loxley's dad.
Oh man, can you imagine Brian Blessed being in a Mel Brooks movie? Because in this, like, in Men in Tights, again, in Prince of Thieves, he is playing it, you know, very sincerely. But when Brian Blessed is allowed to just be unhinged, it's amazing, and
it really
he
is.
Would have so much fun in this movie, because he does everything huge.
I think there's so many parallels between those two flicks, and I think there's also interchangeable parts. Like, as much as Roger Reese is pretty fantastic in Men in Tights, it could have been Alan Rickman. Alan Rickman was the scene stealer in Prince of Thieves, and I mentioned this to you the other day, but apparently Alan Rickman was so disgusted by the script that he had two of his friends who were writers in Hollywood at the time do punch up for the Prince of Thieves script, and Kevin Reynolds, who directed Prince of Thieves, okayed the new lines, and under the duress of Alan Rickman, who pretty much turned around and said, I need good things to say in this movie, like, everything about this movie isn't that great. But that being said, he could have totally played the Sheriff of Rottingham if he wanted to.
I think so. I think that he brings a level of authenticity to Prince of Thieves, which is great. And I say that because he's a very important and specific element to that movie. Mm-hmm. So when Rickman comes in and he's playing this role, everyone is taking it super seriously, and he is too, but he's also playing it as large as possible. I didn't appreciate this as a kid because I didn't really understand the nuances of such things. But now as an adult, I'm watching him and I've grown up everyone talking about Alan Rickman's huge, you know, like chewing the scenery, you know, scene stealing performance. And I was like, I remember it being pretty like normal, but now I'm watching it. I'm like, all right, because he's playing it. He is essentially Skeletor in this movie, just the noises he's making and just like, and it's a Skeletor like cackling that he's doing in live action.
It really is. And you pointed out something else too, where if anybody's listening to this, like go watch Prince of Thieves again. And you pointed this out to me the other day about how it seems like most of, if not all of Alan Rickman's scenes in the movie are kind of shot very close with a fisheye lens. And that is kind of a testament to the character being so vain with really no reason to be vain. And I think that's like, that's the essence of that character. The intro to the Sheriff of Nottingham in Prince of Thieves is him receiving a bust of himself and into his bedroom and looking upon it as if it were a gift from on high. But the performance is so over the top. He would have fit so perfectly in this movie and not change it, not have to change a thing.
If he did that, though, we would have lost the performance of Roger Reese, which,
yes.
I mean, acclaimed theater actor, veteran of the Royal Shakespeare Company. He brings I don't want to say like this movie doesn't deserve his talent, but, you know, he brings a level of talent to a literal dick and fart movie that is just like vastly almost incompatible because it's so high. But he plays Rottingham with the same commitment and sincerity that he would play Hamlet. And I sincerely believe that the film wouldn't be as remembered fondly if he wasn't bringing like this A game to this silly, silly movie.
Absolutely. And, you know, let's go into Richard Lewis, because like he rounds out the cast perfectly as well as like the one of the main characters in the film.
Yeah. Roger Reese in the behind the scenes thing that I watched, he says something that, and I agree with 100%. I couldn't think of a better way to say it. He says that Richard Lewis is the wrong person for this role, and it's perfect. And he's absolutely right, because everyone else is trying to, even though they're doing over the top performances, they are trying to portray a character, and Richard Lewis is just being Richard Lewis. And it's perfect, because it's so funny just for him to be this, you know, not anachronistic, but he's not even trying to fit in. He's just being Richard Lewis. And it's hilarious.
I've always loved Richard Lewis. I love him on Curb Your Enthusiasm. I think he's such a funny part of that show. And whenever I watch Curb, and it's like an older Richard Lewis, he looks like such a ghoul, you know?
Yeah.
But watching this movie again, it dawned on me, he's always been a ghoul. Kind of like a little bit hunched over, very like ghoul-like features, you know, like, but that doesn't take away from like how hilarious he is in this movie, and his comic timing is so perfect. It seems like he just had that one take magic in Men in Tights, where the cameras are on, he'll nail his lines on the first go, and that's a wrap.
Oh yeah, so much. The story continues. Marion in this movie is an interesting diversion from the Prince of Thieves one, because she's very much the damsel in distress, but there's a specific plot line in this movie that the other movies don't have, and it's her virginity being locked up in a chastity belt, and her true love is the person who has the key, and this is her destiny, and that's something that we are introduced to while she is singing in a bathtub about the love that she wants to have. What?
No, I'm agreeing with you. Please, okay. Please continue. Yeah.
it sounded like you were like, yeah, the bathtub. And you started laughing. And I was like, well.
No. Please continue.
Tell me what's funny. The chastity belt thing. I remember this as a kid. I got what was going on. But my question, and it remains to this day, is just like, you know, maintenance.
Oh yeah.
How do you do normal stuff Because hers is like, I realized that these were certain things that very disturbing and cruel things that actually existed, but not to this extent, because hers is like iron underwear
that
ostensibly does not come off.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, that you got to go to the bathroom. You got to, you know, I know you're in the bath, but I feel like, you know, not to get too detailed, but you got to, you know, you got to scrub things sometimes.
You got to take care of business down there. You know what you're saying?
Yeah.
Too bad we don't have a sponsor right now that's kind of tangential to what you're just talking about.
Oh, yeah. Like some sort of like Rust-Oleum or something.
Yeah, sure.
Or Everlast.
I mean, you don't have to make sense of everything. I think that's the beauty of these movies, especially with a comedy like this. You know, like, I don't think anybody in the movie theater was like, well, how are you supposed to poop, man?
Like, this movie is ridiculous. And any anachronistic or non-fitting thing doesn't matter. It's a comedy. Mm-hmm. It's a parody. However, I was definitely sitting there going, how do you poop, lady? How do you poop?
Ruminating. You were ruminating about it.
I was stewing. Yeah. And while you were waiting to talk about the Game Gear and Rumble in the Bronx for 25 years,
I've been waiting
this long to figure out how you go to the bathroom in that particular chastity belt.
Well, lucky for you, we have Mel Brooks on the line. Mel Brooks.
Oh, I would die.
Imagine if he just addressed your poop question right
now. Right.
So moving forward, like, again, this is, the movie's so much fun. You get lost in the fun of the movie. And, you know, like, the parallels at some point to Prince of Thieves stop and it just becomes its own thing. You know, like, it really, really, really gets heavy on the 90s references at this point. You know, like, the story is continuing, but you also get at one point you get a Malcolm X speech from Dave Chappelle.
Right.
Sherrod Forrest landed on us, which is like the famous speech from a Malcolm X flick that Denzel Washington delivers. Stuff like that, I think, is so much fun. But again, watching this movie now, let's say you're like 20 years old or 15 years old, would you get that reference?
Yeah, this movie, again, there are so many specific 90s things and specific movies that had come out very recently, like the Malcolm X speech, White Man Can't Jump. He makes a reference to that. There is there's a scene where the horse, when they go to the castle, someone puts the club on the horse, you know, the anti-theft thing. Which very specifically, you know, a 90s thing, which they still sell, by the way. I had to look that up.
Oh, that's interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, I don't know who's using it. And and there's like cars and steering wheels have all changed at this point. But the fact that the club, you can actually go and buy like still the club and think it's going to protect you, since it's long since been, you know, sort of debunked as an anti-theft thing. But But again, like, I remember at the 90s, that was a thing where it's like, we're going to put the club so no one steals our cars. Like, you know, like, it was one of those like scare, you know, news scares. People are stealing your car, you know, get the club.
Before we move on to the second act, I also want to mention how amazing Tracy Ullman is as Latrine in the movie.
Yeah, you have a thing for Tracy Ullman, don't you?
I love, it's not a sexual thing, but I do love Tracy Ullman.
You know what I mean?
I do love Tracy Ullman. I think she's hysterical. And again, I'm going to bring it up with the Larry David thing, because Richard Lewis was in Curb Your Enthusiasm for many years. And she is a phenomenal addition to this season of Curb Your Enthusiasm also. Like, she has this interesting, indefinable quality about her that's just pure genius, you know? And her performance as Latrine is hysterical. I think she was another one who probably does so much prep for the role she's in and then does like brilliant one take magic. And in this flick, she's obsessed with the Sheriff of Rottingham to the point of hilarity.
I agree. I think she's, you know, like one of our classic comedic geniuses, and she brings, like you said, that energy to the movie. A fantastic addition. And that's another strange direct parallel from the Prince of Thieves thing that added to the legend, this whole idea of the witch that was never part of it and was something made up for the Kevin Costner movie. And but because of that, we have this great opportunity for her to play this very lusty weirdo and get all these jokes and performances, especially when she's matched with Roger Rees.
Oh yeah. You know, like everybody works very well together. And I think that's a hallmark of Mel Brooks movies. You know, like you don't want to cast a comedy with duds. Everybody, I feel like, works together so beautifully and intrinsically in this movie. And it works so, so well that this is one of those things where it's like, as outdated as some of these jokes are, this comedy will stand the test of time because the cast is so fantastic. So in Act Two, you have an archery tournament, which is a trap to lure Robin Hood out of hiding by the Sheriff of Rottingham. Robin's captured. Marion promises to marry the sheriff if he spares Robin's life. So this kind of goes also back to the legend of Robin Hood, you know? And one of my favorite versions of Robin Hood is the Disney Robin Hood. When was the last time you watched that, if any at all?
I don't have any real I don't have any memories of that. I think I saw it as a kid, and that's it. I don't think I've ever seen it before.
It's beautiful. That. It's beautiful, and it holds up. I watched it with my niece not too long ago, and I was like, "Yo, this is amazing. This is still amazing." You know, it's beautiful. So like, it's kind of like all the Robin Hoods are thrown into this, which I kind of find very fascinating.
Well, I think this is also why that the movie it holds up on its own, because when at this point it really sort of, I don't want to say deviates, but it's made its Prince of Thieves references and starts to follow the classic story. So, for instance, Prince John is in this, which is not, he was not a part of the Kevin Costner movie. And then we have the banquet scene where he shows up to sort of threaten the prince and tell him I'm coming for you if you don't act right. Mm-hmm. And there's like that big Errol Flynn fight scene that's directly from that classic Robin Hood.
Oh yeah.
So like you said, the archery tournament, which I don't remember that being part of the legend offhand, but it was a big part of the Disney one. That one I do know. And the other thing too is like we get these great Richard Lewis things, like when they have the guard running through the castle, he's sitting going like, I hope it's worth the noise. Mm-hmm. And this is one of several lines from this movie that I still use pretty much every day.
That works. I don't know if there's any lines in this movie that I use in my day-to-day life, but there's certainly lines in this movie that make me guffaw every time I hear them. Like when Robin is introduced to Will Scarlet and he's like, actually, my real name is Will Scarlet O'Hara. Achu and Robin look at each other very inquisitively, and Will Scarlet goes, we're from Georgia.
Yeah.
You know, like a blatant reference to Gone with the Wind. I know it's a dumb joke, but listen, that dumb joke makes me laugh so hard. Rabbi Tuckman, the introduction to Rabbi Tuckman, when he says hello and he takes off his hat and the curls are attached to the hat.
Oh, 100%.
Evergreen joke that will always make me laugh. We're not going to get into the oh no's of you can't say this anymore, you can't say that anymore. There's a lot of this movie that, you know, we shouldn't be repeating in the modern landscape of things and entertainment, which, you know, like a lot of this stuff probably would not see the light of day if this movie was made now. But that being said, Rabbi Tuckman thinks that the merry men are homosexuals. And right. Robin Hood stops him and goes, we're straight. But we're just merry.
We're just merry.
You know, another funny line, and another funny line that always gets me is when they're at the tournament and the merry men are dressed like women and Chappelle turns around and goes, oh, let's get out of these ladies' clothes and get back into our tights. Like that will always make me laugh.
My favorite joke of the movie is Prince John has a mole, and every time he's on the camera that changes and they acknowledge it.
So
and it has like Roger Reese going like, hey, stop me if I'm wrong, but wasn't your mole on the other side? And the way that Richard Lewis goes, I have a mole, stops me dead 100%. Like,
it's so good
without fail.
It's so good. This, you know, like the more we're talking about it and unpacking the movie, I really think this was the Robin Hood premise is so loose compared to everybody's performance in this.
Yeah, it's such a loose thing. It looks like it was such a good time just to hang out and make the movie because they're all like these small jokes that are thrown in. Some of them feel scripted. Some of them feel like they're out of the blue. Like when, so the blind character in the movie, he's the blind servant from the Prince of Thieves one. In this movie, he's called Blinken because he's blind. And there's a moment where Achu is like, "Hey, Blinken," and he goes, "Did you say Abe Lincoln?" And it just comes, it feels like such a on the spot joke. And again, like, it doesn't fit anything, and it's a silly joke. Makes me laugh every time.
No, that is a fantastic joke. It's the wordplay that, again, evergreen joke. That's the wordplay of any Mel Brooks movie. And, you know, it's just like stuff like that. You just eat up. And that's what makes these movies like super like endearing. And this, that line, like Abe Lincoln, did you say Abe Lincoln? That line predates one of my favorite lines of a movie that happens 2 years later in Die Hard 3. Okay. Where Bruce Willis.
Oh, hey, Zeus.
Hey, Zeus. Right. Where Bruce Willis is talking to Sam Jackson's character, Zeus. And he's like, "Hey, Zeus." And he's like, "No, my name is not Hey Zeus. I'm saying like, Hey Zeus, you know."
Hey, comma Zeus.
Hey, comma Zeus. It's kind of like the same. It's in the same vein as that.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I really appreciate that. So tons of sight gags in the whole movie. You know, this is an audio podcast, so we can't really get into the sight gags. But there's one excellent sight gag that happens at the tournament, which is a great 90s reference, in which, you know, Robin kind of screws up shooting the arrow at the target because one of the thugs hits him in the leg, and he pulls out a Patriot arrow, which at the time America was in the Gulf War One, and Patriot missiles were a thing. That I feel like is a reference that is probably lost to time at this point.
It's that, and then it's like earlier they're saying like, "Well, we have these stealth catapults," because there was like the stealth bombers, and yes, these are the things that were in the news at the time. Very, very specific to that era. So I think the audience does the Arsenio woof.
You know, yes.
Super, super specific 90s thing. You sure, you probably know that, you know, if you're a fan of comedy and things like that. But again, like, that was very much a direct reference to a thing at the time. Even like when they have to, like, "Oh, we have to get the villagers. Let's fox them." It's like, cause they're faxing. We didn't have emails or texts. And that was like the cleverest thing that they could do to get the message out.
If you guys are listening to this right now and you've never seen this movie, I implore you to watch it and let us know what you think. I would love to get the opinion of somebody who maybe a little bit younger than us, who has never seen this movie, just to get their reaction, you know, because I think the Arsenio whoop is a great example of somebody who is unindoctrinated into this kind of referential storytelling. I want to see what their reaction was, because I kind of feel like a lot of people would just be like, "What are they doing? What does this guy do?" You know what I mean?
They might not know it's a reference. They just might see, you know, an enthusiastic audience responding to something, you know. Maybe they think, "Oh, they're like," if they saw it in something else, they're like, "Oh, they're whooping like in the Robin Hood movie."
Oh, that's very interesting. Also, another phenomenal actor comedian to round out the cast even more is, about halfway through the movie, you get introduced to Dom DeLuise playing Don Giovanni, who is the Godfather-esque mafia don in England at this time. And his scene is so friggin' perfect. I believe Dom DeLuise was like in his early 60s when they filmed this. And, you know, like, we could definitely do a deep dive into like Dom DeLuise's comedic history at some point during the show, which I would love to do. Like, I would love to do your Cannonball runs and those Burt Reynolds movies that had Dom DeLuise as like a side character in them, because those are hysterical. But, you know, comedic genius in his own right. Dom DeLuise shows up. It's always a pleasure to see him. And Mel Brooks has come out and said, when Dom DeLuise was on set, he would always add an extra 2 days to the calendar whenever he knew he would be filming Dom DeLuise, because he couldn't get any work done. So he would allot for shooting, but also an extra 2 days for laughter.
I totally understand that. In fact, one of the notes that I wrote for the scene was, I can't imagine getting through any of these scenes without cracking up and having to stop and do a reset, because he's, you know, he's doing a very, like, he's doing the Godfather, his best Godfather impression. It's super over the top. But like you said, Dom DeLuise, you know, comedy genius. He's worked with Mel Brooks many, many times over the years. And I'm just watching him deliver these lines and own the scene. And I'm sitting there, I'm trying to imagine sitting across from him as like Roger Reese is doing and not just completely losing it.
Yeah. I do think, and plus, like, we kind of take for granted like the way movies used to be made, where, you know, up until a certain time, everything was very much shot on film. And film is very expensive.
Right.
So I can't imagine the extra budget that needed to be allotted just for people who crack up, you know, but these guys are professionals. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like there must have been some kind of magic in the air too, you know, and like great blocking by Mel Brooks, you know, who probably knew better at this point.
just to have everyone's face not on, you know, in frame or looking the other way. So if they start giggling or cracking up, they could still use it.
Oh yeah. So far, so good, man. Like the movie, like I think, you know, before we started this podcast, not the podcast as a whole, but this particular episode, I was very much like questioning, does this movie hold up or does it not hold up? I think it holds up at this point. So we're not even at act three yet, but just talking with you about it, I do think it holds up a lot, even though it is 90s reference heaven.
It does get the ball rolling very quickly. I think it gets a lot of stuff out of the way early. And yeah. Then from there, again, like putting the 90s stuff aside, it does start hitting these beats one after the other. Like he gathers his merry men. They meet, you know, Rabbi Tuckman, which I think is a great adaptation for, you know, the Friar Tuck thing into this movie, especially, yes. You know, like, you know, with, you know, who Mel Brooks is and culturally speaking, what a brilliant, brilliant move. So we get deep into the legend. We have the tournament, and now we have, you know, the sheriff finally capturing Robin Hood. No matter what the tournament was a sham from the beginning. He's captured. Marion promises to marry him, and if she spares his life, but he is set up to be hung just in case she bails. Now that's when like the villagers and the merry men start coming to the castle for the big final battle.
Yeah, which is a lot of fun, to be honest. Like you wrote in the notes, you can't help but giggle at the hangman's performance.
Oh, he's great.
He's so great. He's a very old school actor. Like I mentioned at the top of the pod that he played a hangman in Blazing Saddles.
Yeah, that was a great reference. I think also he had an eye patch, but it was on the other eye in that movie.
Mm-hmm. And I love the little noose hanging from his hangman's hood. It's just like these little touches, you know, and just all the stuff that he's saying to Robin, and Cary Elwes is no selling it. Very straight faced. The movie really picks up, and Mel Brooks does action in a very fun way.
Yeah, I think so.
The Robin is about to be hanged. There's the wedding of Marion and the sheriff. Merrymen show up. Rottingham is vanquished, but it's all comedy. There's nothing murderous really in this movie.
No, I don't think anyone really gets stabbed until the end. And even that way, it's done in a very sort of silly manner where it was just sort of, you know, like, I was stabbed. And he just kind of goes off camera and then they switch the angle. You know, like when you were playing with swords as a kid and you just sort of stick it in between someone's arm. And you're like, ooh. That's the level of quote unquote violence that the movie has.
Mm-hmm. Dick Van Patten shows up as the abbot,
right?
And then you get, I'm gonna take something from your notes right here. When he walks into frame, somebody yells, "Hey, abbot!"
I hate that guy.
Which is that is a very old school reference.
This is the thing where there are the timely references at the time, and then there are these references to classic old school Hollywood. Does Abbott and Costello have the cultural significance as it does? Does it have it now as it did then? Especially like in the 90s, it was a dated reference. And that was for your parents or for older people who saw that movie. I'm very curious to see if anyone would laugh at that joke or understand what it's in reference to if they watch that movie now.
I think I'm going to agree and disagree with you. So when we were kids, I'm sure we've talked about this before. When we were kids, I didn't have cable growing up, and TV was full of just old timey shit, you know? And I remember getting that reference because I used to watch Abbott and Costello, you know, even in like the early 90s or late 80s. Now, like I said, TV was full of reruns. And I remember as a kid very vividly watching, you know, like My Three Sons, Make Room for Daddy, Lone Ranger, Bewitched, I Dream of Jeannie, Bonanza, Gunsmoke, a lot of like Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy, Charlie Chaplin. A lot of this stuff was on television, right? And not only was it on television, but it was a lot of this stuff was on very cheap VHS. Yeah. And I remember going to like, let's say like on Sunday, I'd go with my mom and my grandmother while they were out like shopping. And I was a kid, you know, and like we had VCRs. And there would be like a 3-pack of like Abbott and Costello flicks or Three Stooges flicks, right? So you get like 8 hours of content for like $3, right?
Right.
$6, you get 16 hours of content. And, you know, we'd get them, bring them home, watch them, pop them in on like a Sunday afternoon, you know, like fast forward through the shit that you don't like and then watch the rest of it. So for us, I think it's still timely in a weird way, even though it's very anachronistic to the time period. Now, though, I just think because of the age of streaming, the lack of old school references, that Hey Abbott reference will be lost on a modern audience big time.
No, I agree. And we've pointed out before, like how we are these weird, we're like the analog to digital switchover generation. So like a lot of this stuff is things that we have an inordinate amount of experience with. Older things that were made for, you know, people that wasn't made for us. It was made, you know, 30, 40, 50 years before, you know, we were around and then it was just regurgitated and we were there to absorb it all up. So, you know, I get the reference, but yeah, I guess that's my question now. So I feel like, you know, to our audience, get on our Twitter at Film Zeros and let us know if this reference means anything to you
or any of the references, to be honest, in this, you know, like if you're not, I think not to gatekeep with age, but I, again, like I want the opinion of somebody who's maybe like, let's say 10 years younger than us, somebody who's 30 years old.
Yeah.
You know, like, will they get that 30 and younger? Will they understand the references without having to do the research? Because I feel like that's a tough thing in and of itself. You know, like how do you type into Google? Like, hey, Google, in this movie, this guy said this. Like, what does that mean? You know, without having somebody to explain it from you to you, you know, unless there's like some kind of script breakdown, which would be a cool thing to see, you know, like script breakdowns of older movies where there's like little parenthetical comments that key you in on what a certain reference is, you know, because even when you watch like, you know, let's take Casablanca, Shot in the Dark right there. Let's take Casablanca. I'm sure there are a million references in Casablanca that if we watch that movie now, we have no idea what they're talking about, you know, like references to like the Crimean War or some shit like that.
Yeah, it's all those things that are out of context. And I know that just going all the way back to the beginning, when you said that one of your favorite jokes is the Will Scarlett O'Hara, you know, the referencing Gone with the Wind, understanding that it is a classic Hollywood film, still to me is kind of a reach and an old reference for a movie like that. I mean, I think the performance saves it. I think that when he's like, we're from Georgia, I think that like that little line delivery makes the joke work. And it's also an in joke because, you know, that's, it's a direct reference to the movie. It's not just a funny name wordplay. Like you didn't just match, you know, Scarlett O'Hara. You didn't just do that. You actually made it like, yeah, no, there's a connecting thread to there. And I think that's funny. But yeah, like it would be, you're right in that sense where there's going to be movies that have references within them. And I think it's sort of fascinating how like the further away we get from them, what these jokes mean to the movie and to the audience that's watching them years and years and years after the fact.
That is very interesting. Do you think if there was an update to this somehow, if this movie was made now, that line in the movie, that specific Scarlett O'Hara line would be, my name's actually Will Scarlett Johansson.
You know what? That would make it more timely. I think, to be honest with you, I think if they did that, they'd probably leave it because Gone with the Wind is such a classic hallmark of film that it would probably... withstand the test of time. But yeah, I think like there are so many things where you could remake this movie and then change all these like little things. You know, people would be texting instead of faxing somehow.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, yeah. That's that. You know, like the more it's also like you kind of. It kind of goes into the more things change, the more they stay the same kind of thing. You know, like you pointed yeah. out the during the, one of the sword fights, the PA gets stabbed, the guy trying to get a bagel. You can still do that joke.
All the other, a lot of the jokes still sort of stay in, especially when it comes to the way that Mel Brooks likes to poke fun and have fun with the idea of movie making. Like, you know, they're doing a thrust of a sword. And it goes off to the set and, you know, some PA's lunch gets stabbed and you see it in behind the scenes going like, hey, come on. You know, a camera is on a crane and it's pushing into a window. And when they cut to another camera, the other one keeps going and shatters the window. You know, the Abbott's staff bumps in like a camera. And there's all like these like very obvious sort of like, hey, we're in a movie. People are looking down the barrel of the of the camera and just speaking to the audience directly going like, ah, I was this close to touching his wiener. You know, it's not taking movie making as seriously, if barely at all. And that's part of the fun.
Even though the set pieces and the movie itself is shot pretty wonderfully, you know, like it really brings you into the time. Like the costumes aren't a joke, you know, like everything was costumed so perfectly and fantastically. And I think that's, you know, you can't really expect anything less from Mel Brooks. You know, it's one thing to do a comedy that's ham-fisted and, you know, rely on jokes that looks like shit. The movie itself visually looks like shit, but Mel Brooks has that history of like making everything look so apropos of the time period, you know, Young Frankenstein, Blazing Saddles, and this movie too, you know, like these are all period pieces. Mel Brooks is period pieces.
Yeah, you're right. And I think that he respects it and that comes through. I'm saying like, he's not taking it seriously, but he obviously has a respect for the medium. He loves the medium and that stuff comes through. I want to ask you a very specific technical thing.
Go ahead.
I agree. I think this movie, the way it's shot, and I think visually it looks really good. Do you think that this movie looks better than Prince of Thieves?
You know what? I thought about that while I was doing the rewatch. I sat through Prince of Thieves in order to sit through this movie. And I'm not saying sit through like it was a chore, but at some point during Prince of Thieves, it was a chore. I think Prince of Thieves goes in and out of being shot gorgeously to being extremely leaden and ham-fisted. And also, this kind of goes with what I'm saying. The butt scene in Prince of Thieves shot oddly and also completely unnecessary. I understand why they did it at the time, because Kevin Costner was like the heartthrob. Right. You know, and Kevin Reynolds, who directed Prince of Thieves, I think that's his name. I'm trying to word this well. Sometimes I think the directing of Prince of Thieves falls into TV movie style.
Okay.
You know, where it kind of looks like something is a little bit syndicated, and it might just be the way the director directs things, because his other, I can point out two flicks that kind of have that same, I don't want to say aesthetic, but Waterworld, which was a mess, but there were certain scenes in it where it's like, well, this looks like a TV movie. And the same thing with Count of Monte Cristo. Like, I really enjoyed the Count of Monte Cristo.
Me too.
But there's certain scenes in it where it's like, well, this kind of looks like a TV movie. I think with Men in Tights, you get full blown Mel Brooks, possibly at his directorial best comparatively, you know, because he's doing certain things that he hadn't done before in movies, or he's doing things better than he's done in other movies. Like, let's take the dance number with the Merry Men.
Right.
There's something so magical about that dance number that it's hilarious, even 30 years down the line.
I think, just to go back on what you're saying about the, I think it's very fascinating that you think that Prince of Thieves looks like a made for TV movie, especially
parts of it.
And especially in the context of that was the second biggest movie that year. The only reason why it was number one is because I think Terminator 2 came out the same year. So the, like 1991 or 92's biggest movie to you now looks partly like a made-for-TV movie. I think that's very interesting. But I think that my perspective and some of the things that I noted while I was watching Prince of Thieves was very odd uses of the camera. So we talked about the close up wide angle lens on you know, Alan Rickman, and sometimes, you know, of Guy of Gisborne. And I can see that as a creative choice. You're trying to you know, it's a choice to make them look menacing and odd, you know, to accentuate their characteristics where they are meant to be evil, so that you're trying to make them sort of distorted. You know, it's like a few degrees from like dutching the camera angle to really like make them look very villainous and evil with the use of the camera. That I can understand. But there are a lot of examples where I'm watching it and I'm like, this is the shot that they went with. This is the only thing that they have, you know, where it's a shot that's from it's a long shot from a distance, and they're tied on, let's say, Marion, and she's smiling and the wind is blowing, but then the camera moves, like, but it doesn't move like it was shook by the wind. It was just like it moves up and down, like someone just was adjusting the camera on the tripod or something. And then they just left. That was the shot that they used. A lot of like weird handheld stuff. And it just feels like a handheld thing. There's no smooth movement to things, even though that, you know, it doesn't have to, even if it's meant to be frenetic, it just looks like someone is holding a camcorder. And that's what, when you were saying this movie looks like a made for TV movie, I'm thinking this is one of the biggest budget Hollywood movies of, you know, of the 90s. And they have these weird, very like choppy camera choices. So
it could be, you know, I don't know for sure, but it could also be the second unit. Well, all those shots that we're kind of complaining about, and like, you know, I agree with you. There are certain things where it's like, that's interesting that they went with this shot, you know, instead of just like your filmmaking fundamentals. But, you know, it could also be a case of them doing reshoots or sending a second unit somewhere and being like, hey, listen, like, take care of this. Like, and I think the emphasis on movie making in Hollywood now is a lot. This might sound a little too murky, but I feel like with a big budget movie now, there's less room for error just because there are more critical eyes on a product. You know, 1990, whenever Prince of Thieves came out, you didn't have the internet really nitpicking scene by scene by scene, nitpicking scripts, nitpicking production, costume value, and all that stuff. You know, you just got movies. That being said, I do think Mel Gibson looked at Prince of Thieves biggest.
Mel Brooks.
No. Mel Gibson.
Oh, okay.
Second biggest movie of 1991 or whatever it was, and said, you know what? I think I can do this better, and then made Braveheart, you know, because aesthetically those Prince of Thieves and Braveheart, very, very similar.
Yeah. I see that. I can see structurally that they're similar. And obviously like they didn't have nerds like us scrutinizing the movie to such a degree. And obviously there's a limit of technology. Like we're talking about, this is on film. They couldn't just go like, oh, we'll just, you know, cut here, do that, digitally swap things. It was a whole ordeal, moving heavy cameras and having someone set up, you know, Steadicam technology,
right,
very much in its infancy. With that said, though, going back to Prince of Men in Tights, really sharp looking movie, really, you know, like well saturated, very, you know, the camera movements were nice. Everything, like anything that wasn't a joke, looked really, really good. And I was sort of surprised that this silly, significantly lower budget parody of this, of the other movie, looked fantastically better.
I'll agree with you 100%. And again, but lessons learned, right? Like, so you could look at that and be like, well, I would have done something differently. And then Mel Brooks did. So, you know, at the end of the flick, you get your big reveal, which I feel like is like kind of cool, where you get the king showing up, King Richard shows up. And in Prince of Thieves, it's none other than Sean Connery, which is pretty fantastic. He wanted $1 million to do Prince of Thieves and they said no. So they negotiated him down to $250,000. The movie was already over budget at that point. And Sean Connery donated the $250,000 to, I believe, like some kind of Scottish orphanage or something like that. Don't quote me on that. I'm a little murky on what he did with the money, but I remember that story. And they really wanted Sean Connery to be King Richard.
But he had played Robin Hood in a different movie. And I think that was like a cool screw line.
Interesting. And then in Prince of Thieves, none other than Sir Patrick Stewart as King Richard, which he was knee deep in Star Trek famous at this point.
Absolutely. And he's doing a parody of Sean Connery, not even of King Richard. He's right. Just showing up, putting on like a really exaggerated Scottish burr on his thing. I think his cameo is more substantial than Sean Connery's, because at the end of the movie, now we're at the point where the sheriff has been vanquished. Robin is saved. He, it turns out, has the key to Marion's heart/chastity belt.
Mm-hmm.
So they're destined to be lovers, perfectly fine. And they do the marriage scene with Rabbi Tuckman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Patrick Stewart as the king shows up and sets everything right. Like, he arrests Prince John. He gives Robin his titles back, and he give, you know, he sits sort of like ties up all the loose ends, where Sean Connery just went like, I want to kiss the bride and give her away. And then that was it. It was like he made $250,000 to say like four things and just hang out for a day.
Pretty fantastic, I gotta say. So the movie ends with Cary Elwes, Amy Yazbek. They're about to get busy. They're married. The key does not fit into the chastity belt, and you get one of the funniest ending lines of a movie with the call locksmith bit. What a great way to wrap this up.
Yeah.
So what did you think of this movie?
Kind of like, I think that our discussion sort of lays out that our thoughts of this movie and how we feel about it are kind of all over the place.
Yes.
I want to talk a little bit, some specifics, since we, before we get into that, head to head, if we're comparing movies, who do you think did a better job? If we're talking about Cary Elwes versus Kevin Costner's Robin Hood, what do you think?
I'm going to go Cary Elwes only because, I like Kevin Costner as an actor. He's fine, right? My favorite Kevin Costner role, honestly, Pa Kent in Man of Steel.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
And that's it. You know, like, I know he's been in a ton of great flicks. Again, Wyatt Earp, Dances with Wolves, et cetera, et cetera. His delivery and accent in Prince of Thieves, when I was a kid, found nothing wrong with it. As an adult, I'm like, yeah, it's different in every scene. I don't know what this guy's trying to do or what this guy's trying to portray, you know? Because he goes from like this lofty, soft voice to like a pseudo British accent to kind of like, I don't know what he's doing. Cary Elwes all the way on this one. What about you?
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's, I want to say it's a no-brainer, but I wanted to bring it up because I think they approach the roles in completely different ways. I kind of respect that Costner at some point said, I'm not going to try doing an accent and just do that because it would be super distracting. But at the same time, a lot of his line deliveries feel like he's trying, and he sounds like he's doing a, you know, like a high school Shakespearean production performance. Cary Elwes is also, he's playing the Bugs Bunny version of Robin Hood, where he is being sarcastic and jokey and cartoonish, but at the same time being like wry and playing it kind of silly. But he's also standing there with his chest puffed out and his hands on his hips, like, and it's such a bigger performance and it's very silly. I think that, with that said, Cary Elwes is a more charming and actually kind of more believable Robin Hood.
Yes, I agree with that 1,000%. So up next on your notes, you have Dave Chappelle versus Morgan Freeman. Give me your take on that.
So I think that as far as Dave Chappelle's, what he brings to this role, it's hard to do a direct comparison, but I feel like he is a good addition to Cary Elwes is Robin Hood, because he has, you know, that sarcasm, that the wittiness, where he's pointing out a lot of like the silliness that's happening, like when they're trying to cross the bridge. He's like, this is not a river that we need to ford. We could just step over it, you know. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, he's just pointing out how everyone sounds silly and how just like he's way cooler than everyone. But then we have Morgan Freeman, who is Azeem and brings so much new depth to the Robin Hood story, and to the point where it was such an impactful addition to that story that it is now part of the story from, mm-hmm. you know, from then on. And I think I really liked Morgan Freeman's portrayal in Prince of Thieves more than basically anyone else in Prince of Thieves, apart from Alan Rickman. So
you're giving it to Freeman.
Yes.
Okay. This is a little tomato, apples and oranges here.
Yeah.
For me. But I will also give it to Freeman, and I'm going to give it to Freeman just because like he was so fantastic in that role. And like you said, it became part of the Robin Hood lore as we know it, except oddly enough, like, I don't think that was in the, I don't think it was in the Ridley Scott Robin Hood, which is another movie I really enjoyed.
Yeah. That one kind of went under the radar for a lot of people.
It did, but it's a very enjoyable movie. And it kind of takes the legend and makes it make a little more sense if it was like a real, like if it was actually like a real thing, you know, like, oh, of course, you know, like he did fight in the Crusades. He was just like a tired guy basically. But Morgan Freeman, like really doing research, acting it up, like really, really like having like an awesome performance. Right. What I find interesting is like, and this is like nitpicking, but there's a scene, again, watching through an adult lens, there's a scene in the beginning of the movie where they're breaking out of jail, right? Morgan Freeman is basically yelling at Robin Hood, Christian, you can't save them, but you can save me, right?
Yeah.
Makes sense. He's only tied up by a rope. The other guys are in chains. You know, Robin is trying to destroy the chains or whatever. Cuts Morgan Freeman loose. He helps him get out. But then the next thing pretty much that Morgan Freeman's character says to him is, why did you free me? And it's like, dude, you were yelling at me to free you, which is kind of funny. You know, like that's kind of an interesting. I just think that's just like the screenplay of the movie. You know, it's like nothing to do with their performances, but it's just like a fun, weird thing to point out. Yeah, I'm going to go Freeman. So far, Cary Elwes, great Robin Hood, Morgan Freeman, fantastic Azeem. Now,
This is the hardest question I'm going to ask you is, which is the better sheriff, Roger Reese or Alan Rickman?
I'm going to try to be quick about this one. Now, I think Rickman could have been in both movies, but I don't think Reese could have been in both movies.
Okay.
I'll go Rickman. Rickman as the sheriff he's so delightful. It borders on lunacy. Like you said, he's basically Skeletor. He's so over the top. His delivery is so fantastic. His comedic chops are... People underestimate Alan Rickman a lot. I think his comedic chops are so amazing. You know, like if you've ever seen Galaxy Quest, you'll know what I'm talking about. But
yes,
Rickman, all the way.
Interesting. I don't know. I think it's a tough question because I think that they are... The things that they do, they both do for their respective roles is just bring their A game and make it huge and take it completely serious and just do the most with what they're given. Rickman obviously is like in this role of this, it's an American led period piece of Robin Hood, and he just hams it up and is a scene stealer for sure. Mm-hmm. And making this silly movie that I feel like a lot of people who were working in it had mixed feelings about, or just kind of like, well, this is like a dumb job, but it's a gig. Let's get it. He turned it down twice and he's like, listen, I'll do it if you just let me go crazy. And, you know, that was his version of just kind of like, I'm going to just do the most with what I'm given. And I feel like Roger Reese, who has such a very, classic background, like a super intense actor who has done so much in the way of, you know, and I'm not trying to diminish Rickman's acting performance or career, but you kind of get this sense that people who come from the Royal Shakespeare Company have this level of intensity. It's like being like a, you know, being so classically trained in that sort of acting, that level of dramatic acting. And then to take that same level of intensity and seriousness and legitimacy and then go to Mel Brooks's silly boner movie about Robin Hood, mm-hmm. and just do the same performance, I think is amazing. And I think it's, as an artifact, it's just fascinating because he is leading a lot of the movie when he is interacting with Robin Hood, when he is, you know, setting his back and forth with Richard Lewis and all the other things that he's doing, especially with the witch. I don't know. I feel like Roger Reese, this is such a showcase for him. And when I said before, like, maybe he shouldn't be remembered for this, you know, throughout, as far as like his career is, is concerned, maybe he should be, because he, it is, it's such an exemplary professional job to me, that it stands out to me more than Rickman stands out in the other movie.
Okay. Okay. That's fascinating. That's a, that's an interesting take on it. I'm inclined to agree, but I'm still going to go Rickman.
That's totally fine.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel like we covered a lot of the feelings about this movie, but you know, what do you think, Rich, now that we've watched them again?
I still love it. Does it do it for me as much as other Mel Brooks movies? I'm going to put it maybe in the middle of the list.
Okay.
We're going to get, like I said, we're going to get to most, if not all, of the Mel Brooks stuff, but I think Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein are perpetually in my top two, because I watch them, I think, at least once or twice every year. You know, like they're on in some form or fashion. Spaceballs as well, but I don't think I've watched Spaceballs in quite a while, just because I've seen it so many times, you know, where I'm like, I have maybe two more watches in me before I go, you know what, I don't have to watch Spaceballs for another like 6 years or something like that. This movie, I love it. It holds up in an odd way, but also I think just because of the heavy 90s references, it's not cringy, but it's borderline cringy just because it's a little too corny. You know, I hate using that word for a Mel Brooks movie, but I just think it's like, as much as I love this movie, I do think a lot of it just ends up being corny after being removed from 30 years removed from the reference.
I think I land similar on the same spot where you are, because like, we came in asking two questions: does it hold up, and do you need to watch Prince of Thieves? I feel like we answered that you don't need to have to do a back-to-back comparison, because I feel like, yeah, it's got the bones of a Prince of Thieves parody, but once it sort of gets the ball rolling, that's it. You don't have to watch that movie and get the rest of the references. However, you probably have to be a product of the 90s or have watched this in the 90s to really get a lot of the stuff, because it leans more on time than timely 90s references than it does on directly parodying the Kevin Costner movie. Does it hold up? I feel like we mentioned before that some of that stuff is eyebrow raising. You know, the whole title of the movie and a dance number is sort of predicated on the joke where it's like, here are guys, they're wearing tights, it's ha-ha-ha, women's clothes, but don't worry, they're still manly. It's a tired joke, especially nowadays. And, you know, I feel like, you know, I'm not going to speak for any group, and I'm not going to talk, you know, on behalf of Mel Brooks, but like, my perspective is, I never saw his comedy as punching down to anybody. But you know, everyone is on equal ground, and the ribbing is always done in good fun, again, from the way I see it. And I always think that, you know, we say something is a product of its time because it's a good way of sort of, we have to sort of do things for, we say that for certain things, because some things need to be scrutinized. Some things probably, it's difficult. I'm trying to choose my words carefully, because we have to take a lot of these things seriously. And, but some things are just, this is how the culture was then. And to scrutinize certain things takes away or misses the point from what we're trying to do. I'm not saying that everything gets a pass, and I'm not handing out passes. It's not for me to do, but I always kind of thought that Mel Brooks never did anything maliciously with his comedy. If it was sort of off the mark, he would change it and he would sort of evolve, because his goal is to not poke at someone who doesn't want to be poked. It's to make them laugh. And if someone says, look, that's not funny, he'd be like, fine, it's not funny. I'm not here to do that. I'm here to be funny. And you can argue that his comedy has changed over the years. And that's why I still think that it's, yeah, that some of this stuff is like a little bit cringy, and maybe it's corny, and maybe some of it is a little uncomfortable, but nothing is mean. And you can appreciate it because it's just trying to make you laugh. It's sort of like defending, you know, like a dad's joke or a dad's sense of humor, where it's like, okay, this is dated, but I get a kick out of it because he's just trying to make me laugh, and it's not coming from a bad place. So in that sense, I don't think it holds up entirely based, basically having said all that stuff, I think like, yeah, the references are super timely. Even growing up in that era, I still had to go and to look up some of the jokes because I don't remember specifically what they were talking about. I mean, I loved it watching it on TV. I remember seeing it in theaters actually. But I also remember it being on TV all the time. You know, at the time my brother and I loved it. Even like the more mature jokes, but we were watching it and we had a very immature sense of humor because we were children and a lot of the immature jokes landed because they were just as immature. As an adult, the jokes feel like really out of style. It's almost like kind of like we're talking about like a fascinating artifact of the past. But I still think that the movie is goofy and fun. You know, I have a difficult time separating the nostalgia aspect of it, but I think there are genuinely good comedy bits in this that still hold up. And it's that kind of comedy that throws everything at the wall and sees what sticks. You know, the things that stick, they land, they're funny. The thing that doesn't, it doesn't, but that's just how it goes. And I appreciate the sincerity of the performances, you know, even though they're exaggerated, you know, I feel like everyone has had a lot of fun making this movie and that translates when I watch it.
Well said. I agree with you. I think as far as the jokes go, you know, like some stuff, you know, by cringy, I think it's just there, you know, like sensibilities change and sensibilities in comedy are always changing. And we live in a very interesting time right now where, you know, there's an extreme sensitivity to things and then there's an extreme lack of sensitivity to things, you know? So when you're a self-aware person like we are, I think, you know, you take note and you sit back and you kind of consciously go like, hey, wow, I don't think they could get away with, I don't think Hollywood could get away with a lot of stuff that was in this movie, but at the same time, it's harmless fun. And take that number, for example, the Men in Tights dance number, you know, I laugh throughout it because I know it's not malicious. Like you said, it's not punching down at anybody, but could you get away with that now? You know, could you get away with some of the stuff the rabbi says? Could you get away with some of the references in the movie? I don't know, but that question does not detract from the fun I have watching this movie. You know, it's still fun. I'll sit through it again because it's fun. You know, maybe in 10 years from now, comedy might evolve even more, you know? And also, you know, this movie was done in 1993, and you got to remember, like, this is the least extreme comedy, I think, that you're going to get. You know, there's plenty of stuff that was made in the early 90s that's like, oh my God, this would never be made, you know? And it was, you know, it was the time of like, you know, lascivious talk shows were starting to come out of the forefront, like your Richard Bay. I think Jerry Springer was a little later on, but you had like early 90s just coming out of the hedonistic 80s to the extreme early 90s, where you still had guys like Andrew Dice Clay just ripping it up. You know what I mean? And I think that kind of stuff, you can never do that now, right? Like that is, it was said and done in the early 90s. And this movie just is like, almost like a gentle reminder of like, this is the time we were, you know, you had your political jokes, you had your sexual jokes, much like we do now, but, you know, through a different lens. That being said, listen, I love this movie.
Yeah, my affection for Mel Brooks goes very far. I have, you know, a very nostalgic connection to this. You know, I like the Robin Hood story in general, and this is like a great send up of all of that. Referencing the 90s is great. Just, you know, I feel like we just have to address, like, when we're talking about old movies like this that poke fun at things. I from my perspective, I feel like, you know, we have to look at things from a lens, you know, that from our current lens, because that's where we're at, you know, it's unavoidable. And I just wanted to sort of address that because I feel like with Mel Brooks and in this movie in particular, like you said, there's all like that being inflammatory was in style at the time. And I don't think that this was what Mel Brooks was trying to do. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's also just like the people that he's quote unquote making fun of. It's the fun part. It's like, it's poking around. It's like, we're all in the same boat. We're all on the same team. I'm giving everyone, grief because I'm just teasing culturally what we're doing, you know, my culture, your culture, this sort of thing. And I'm also sending up this movie and filmmaking. Everyone's mileage may vary. And I think there's a lot of people from, you know, comedy legends that who have carried on and still do stuff and are around now that maybe like my opinions of them have changed because there's like, well, it turns out like you're kind of scummy and you're sort of doubling down on things and not changing with the times and maybe sort of being as reflective. And I feel like Mel Brooks doesn't fall in that category. So no. I have an easier time watching something like this because he didn't like turn like old milk into something bitter and gross. The genuineness and the good intentions are still coming through.
One of my favorite self-referential jokes in this, and then you'll take us out after this, but is when they make Achu the new sheriff of Rottingham. And then I believe somebody in the audience goes, a black sheriff, that's never going to work. And then Dave Chappelle turns around and goes, well, it worked in Blazing Saddles. I think that kind of joke is the essence of a Mel Brooks movie.
Yeah, I think so too. Well, I feel like we covered a lot of ground. We talked about two movies. We talked about Mel Brooks extensively, and I had a great time. I hope you did too. Thanks for joining your Film Class Zeros, and we will catch you on the next one.
Later, guys.